A steep and winding road, designed mainly for horses, drays, and the odd 3-ton truck. This was the Pacific Highway in 1958, when the last tortuous section of gravel was sealed with bitumen. Described by some as a goat track, the Pacific Highway was named so in 1931 because of pressure put by the Queensland government, who had decided to rename their section of road from Tweed Heads to Brisbane the Pacific Highway. Before then, it was simply known as the North Coast Highway, a road used only as a last resort. Vince O'Grady, a former Deputy Engineer-in-Chief of the Department of Main Roads, recalls.
The Pacific Highway defines the history of the evolution of people and goods movement within this state. Initially, it was shipping. Sydney to Newcastle, you went by ship. And Sydney to Windsor, you went out the Heads and you came back in on the Hawkesbury River.
John Brunt was the head of environmental planning at the DMR. He remembers being on holiday once in Yamba during the 1940s.
I had a holiday once in Yamba, and looking out of my window at the hotel, there was a beer used to be brought in by ship, and they had heavy seas and the ship couldn't get in across the bar. So they were contemplating Grafton and Yamba, but running out of beer.
Colin Nunn, development manager at the RTA in Newcastle, gives an idea of what it was like to have been a motorist on the Pacific Highway during the 1930s.
The motorists would have realised that when they were going out, it was going to be a hot, dusty or wet, boggy trip in a lot of instances. It would have been a massive adventure for them because they would have to be facing up with uncertain road conditions. Will they get bogged? Will some of the creeks be flooded? They would probably have to take some additional supplies, I would imagine. Getting there was probably more important than getting there on time. I don't imagine people doing any more than 150 miles a day in those days. I couldn't see them planning a longer trip than that. To drive the Pacific to New Sydney to Brisbane, you would have been crazy. Going that far in those days, people would think you had a screw loose if you took a car. I mean, you've got to realise that back in the 30s, there wasn't a lot of motor vehicles. In around Australia, was a relatively poor country. It went through the Depression and it was did it much tougher than a lot of other countries. So motor vehicle usage was fairly low. So it would have been a domain of the rich or the adventurers or the aficionados or those sorts of people, I would imagine.
Tom Hope, former engineer-in-chief, recalls.
We bought our first car when we were at Dorigo in 1946. And it used to take 15 hours to drive from Dorigo and or Coffs Harbour to Sydney. And mostly over gravel or stone.
Tom Lindsay is now a truck operator. In 1945, he was a 14-year-old on his first trip from Coffs Harbour to Sydney.
Which was my father in a truck. Yes, on the back of a truck too, not in the cab. And there was about two-thirds of the Pacific Highway was gravel. And we were wrapped in blanket and with a tarpaulin over the bottom half of our body. We certainly needed a shower when we got there.
I mean, it's interesting, even close to Newcastle, it was a massive trip, and sometimes between Maitland and Newcastle, people had to wade in bullocks up to their waist to get through the Hexham Swamp. It's interesting, though, that in the 30s, and the New South Wales railway system came to Murwillumbah, and the Queensland system came to Tweed Heads. And one significant reason why they spent a fair amount of money joining the road system between Murwillumbah and Tweed Heads, including those two bridges and eliminating those two ferries, was to join the rail heads together. In the Depression, we had a new bridge at Maxville, Boyd's Bay, Barney's Point, Raleigh, Maroora. I mean, significant capital works were spent eliminating ferries up there. Shark Creek. We actually even had the new route put in between Newcastle and Sydney via Pete's Ferry. It was a very interesting time for the road in the 30s. Even then, I think the New England was seen as the major route and the major freight route.
During the post-war years, with increasing car ownership and population mobility, the realisation grew that the highway would not be able to cater for the expected future needs. With cars now able to reach speeds of 70 miles per hour on a road designed at 1939 standards, and an influx of tourism to coastal communities and increasing traffic volumes, the DMR realised that something had to be done. In 1947, Vince O'Grady had just graduated with a brand new engineering degree in his pocket. He had no trouble finding a job.
Jobs were extremely plentiful. Didn't have to apply for jobs. The jobs came looking for us. There were 27 of us did civil at that time, and two that are paying the most of the Water Resources Commission and Main Roads. I had a close friend, and up went the penny. He got the Water Resources Commission. I got the Main Roads Department. It was actually a toss. So on a Monday morning in February, in my best suit, my only suit, all spruced up, I went in to start work in the structural design section. Oh, look, we'd like to do something else. We'd like to go and see the highways engineer. The highways engineer said, we want you as a field assistant to the Metropolitan Construction Engineer. It was a wet day, so in my best suit by lunchtime, I was out putting in pegs on the Pacific Highway between Crow's Nest and St Leonard's. It was a four-lane road at that time, with the two centre lanes carrying trams, and you could not legally pass a tram on the right-hand side. You couldn't move past a stationary tram. So in morning peaks, the head of the queue was always a tram. We started work at 7 o'clock, a three-quarter hour lunch, and if you work it out, we knocked off about, well, just after 4:30, I think it was, to get the 44 hours in the 5 days. Concreting was always a big thing for the men because it was a very hard day, and you always started at daylight, and you went until you lost the light. In other words, while the weather was good, keep going. Cement came in paper bags. Concrete aggregate came in two sizes. We didn't let traffic on normally for 28 days after pouring. If it had to be quicker, extra bag of cement went into every mix and opened in 7 days.
O'Grady's boss was Bob Milner, a colourful character who had been a captain with Lawrence of Arabia whilst in the Indian Army. The men just called him Uncle Bob.
But one particular day, I'll remember, we got, well, one lane concreted all the way from Chandos Street right up to Falcon Street. And I thought it might have been a record, but perhaps it wasn't. And I was just standing there with the foreman, and we're congratulating ourselves when Uncle Bob turned up. Oh, you went well, yes. While he was standing there, or while the three of us were there, a little sedan car, might have been an Austin or a Morris, worked its way between the barriers at the bottom down at Chandos Street, got onto the wet concrete, and as the car advanced, of course, it started to make depressions in the wet concrete, finally bogged about 40 yards short of us. And as a terrified local housewife, she's just not going to move. Well, she couldn't move the vehicle. She wasn't going to do anything. Uncle Bob just gave a signal, and about eight men got round the car, picked the car up with the woman still behind the steering wheel, carried it across, put it onto the tram tracks, and he said, "Have a good evening, madam."
Peter Cooper is a former locations officer at the DMR and the RTA.
In the 1950s, the DMR did something so enormous that it probably will never be completed. And they decided that the road from Taree to Newcastle that used to go through Gloucester and Stroud would come down through Woolloodoola and Tea Gardens. 120 kilometre deviation. Can you imagine that in the late 90s to even talk about such a thing? This was an enormous decision and they just went ahead and did it. They had very limited resources money-wise, so they knew they just had to keep doing this until it was finished. And there was confidence and there was an enthusiasm to get in, and yes, we're going to do it. Today, we would have so many studies, so many inquiries and investigations and changes of government in between that the concept would probably never get off the ground.
Cooper joined the DMR as a junior draftsman in 1950 and spent his first year in the investigation section. But he really wanted to become a surveyor.
There's a degree of romanticism about surveyors. As a kid growing up, that was that would be great to do, wouldn't it?
To you, what is surveying all about? What's the essence of it? What's the important thing about being a good surveyor?
Being methodical. Being able to plan things.
And what about the recognition of different kinds of terrain and curves and all that sort of thing?
Well, in this business that I was involved in, that's fundamental. O'Grady, at the time, we're looking for somebody, for a new person to come into this activity, and he said he wanted a fellow with the smell of gun leaves up his nose. He wanted somebody from the bush with an appreciation of what the terrain might be like. And what happens, like streams flow downhill. Like, you didn't have to look at a map and look at levels to know that. This was traditional surveying, and nobody had heard of photogrammetry. Nobody had heard of aerial photographs. We did topographic surveys by means of what was known as stadia, where a vertical staff is held. And wherever you are, you read the distance on the staff, on the crosshairs through the telescope or the theodolite. In those days, we filled out a fortnightly journal in which was specified how many hours you spent doing various things, down to a quarter of an hour, how you spent the day. So much field work, so much office work, the cost of postage stamps. This was a fortnightly journal of your activities.
Jack Giddy, a senior road design draftsman, joined the DMR at the age of 15.
We were designing roads in long lengths. You know, we're talking about 20 or 30 kilometres, just stringing them together. And we developed, we used a section where we had the plans printed, the contours, and the photogrammetry printed out in sheets 30, 40 feet long. We were working to get coordination between the vertical alignment and the horizontal alignment and all the factors, all the safety factors that are required to come into road design we could do then. And the draftsmen working on those jobs were able to perceive, or had a good knowledge of how the road would look when it was finished.
Equipment used in the drafting office was basic. John Henley, now a Shire engineer at Tweed Shire Council, started with the DMR at the Port Macquarie Works office in 1966.
It was still very much the days of the pencil and the ink pen, and everything was drawn by hand. Calculations were all done by hand calculators. Early days, we did at least have electric calculators, even though they were mechanical ones. But all detailed calculations were still done with the old seven-figure logs. And surveyors in the field had used to still use the hand-wind calculators where you'd set them and mechanically wind them. And there was still quite a number around then of the old wind-the-handle mechanical calculators. You had electric one where you actually pressed the button. That was a big step forward.
In my field, the greatest advancement was, the development of aerial photography and air photo interpretation.
Another important tool used by the DMR for road location was photogrammetry.
Photogrammetry is the science of using aerial photographs to generate a graphical representation of the terrain. The Department of Main Roads were one of the first users of this system, and from the aerial film, plates are made. Plates are put in these plotting instruments, and people can see the three-dimensional representation of the terrain. The DMR in the 1930s started taking aerial photography on the Pacific Highway and various other highways. In advance of anybody else in Australia, they started doing this. So we've had a long history of reliance on aerial photographs. And in the late 60s, they started to use colour photography. And we used aerial photography in three dimensions. Well, here was a fourth dimension.
From the 60s on, nearly all the location and preliminary work was done from photogrammetry. It was about that time the department had its own helicopter, and we did a lot of work from that. We were getting a better understanding with the engineers and with the so-called hierarchy of the main roads by having them acknowledge the fact that the most important part of the car or the most important part of design is the nut behind the wheel or the driver, and a realisation of the limitations of that driver and putting these limitations into design, which gave a completely different attitude in the approach to road design.
One of the products is to be able to draw contours and spot and take spot heights very, very accurately. It's so accurate that generally when people are first presented with this, they doubt it, that there is some degree of speculation that it can't be right. But in fact, it's true. The DMR bought two cameras for close-up work. They actually did some experimental stuff, some research on potholes, and did a contour survey of a pavement from 4 feet away, drawing contours of, I think, half a millimetre precision.
The complete computerisation of design, fortunately, came after I left. It was coming in as I was leaving. Thank goodness for that. Because I'd seen a situation in Queensland where they try to use computer design, and they've come up with some of the most, well, in my opinion, some of the most dangerous pieces of road you could imagine. And that was because I think the people that were computer designers weren't road designers. They knew about computers, but they didn't know the basis on road design or road design safety.
Only in the last few years has become computers with enough memory to handle all the data at once in a system called GIS, Geographic Information Systems, in which data is overlaid as if you had pieces of paper with all different bits of information on it, sitting one on top of the other, all perfectly coordinated. Well, they do this in a computer using these national grid coordinates. Where it gets really interesting is the ability of the computer to analyse or do analysis on the things that you are really looking at. And if you say you attach 100% importance to environmental issues and 80% importance to topographic issues, let's see where the points of conflict are.
During the 1950s and 1960s, traffic volumes on the Pacific Highway increased dramatically, more than quadrupling pre-war figures. Increasing traffic congestion on the two-lane highway made improvements imperative.
Overtaking lanes were really relatively rare at that stage. Overtaking lanes, in fact, I don't recall them being used anywhere except as climbing lanes. Only at that stage, the only facility for that third lane was, in fact, climbing lanes, which all went back to what heavy trucks were in use at that stage, being relatively low-powered and crawling up hills very slow. And the section from down around Bulladealer, which was relatively new at that stage, was considered to be, you know, one of the very good sections of highway because it had climbing lanes on nearly every hill.
Deviations and road widenings were welcomed, but when towns were bypassed, new problems emerged for local populations. Terry O'Brien, former engineer based at Port Macquarie.
Well, the one at Port Macquarie, for instance, was my first involvement. The only snag was that when people came up from Kew through this winding section through the forest, got out onto this brand new road, they just kept going, and that was opened just before Christmas. And then the people would ring from Kempsey to the motels at Port Macquarie and say, oh, I'll cancel my booking because I'm now at Kempsey, I'm heading north. And we stopped a couple of vehicles after they'd gone past this turn-off, and the driver said, yes, I saw the sign. I told my wife and mother-in-law that Port Macquarie was off to my right, and they said, don't be stupid, this is the way we've always come. So he said, I just kept going.
The local establishments at Port Macquarie were not so happy about the new bypass.
Hated it. I didn't want to be bypassed. The commercial people didn't want to be bypassed. But the highway used to go into Port Macquarie, right into the middle of Port Macquarie. That was one of the first that was built out of town. And the dire consequences were forecast. What a godsend it was. Made Port Macquarie.
Bangalore was the example where the traffic was just nose to tail for long periods. And, it really divided. And now that they bypassed it, it's a lovely little town, totally different. The towns, they seem to stagnate for a while. They don't seem to know how to handle being bypassed initially. But then after a few years, they seem to go from strength to strength when they realise that there is another life without all the traffic roaring through the town.
Ron Smythe, a former divisional engineer with the DMR, recalls.
Raymond Terrace was bypassed, but that bypass is now being bypassed again. In fact, it's opening this week. That's one of the mistakes that the DMR made in those days, was that they bypassed the main street of Raymond Terrace with another road, and then the council would allow development to happen on the bypass, and that's exactly what happened at Raymond Terrace. That bypass that was built then has become choked up with service stations, restaurants, houses, etc., and become a suburban street once again. So the current bypass will bypass that, and hopefully there'll be no development allowed on it.
Much of the DMR's activities to improve the highway centred around the works depots, often in remote areas. Leo D'Adam, a former divisional engineer at Port Macquarie, remembers.
In those days, up to when I got there, the engineers out on work sites had to camp in tents and paid for it. They paid $5 a week for it to live in a tent.
Brian Pearson also spent a year with the DMR at the Port Macquarie Works Office.
There was always an extra tent, and I didn't know what that tent was used for. And one day I poked my head inside and it was full of empty bottles. And I learnt from the foreman in charge of that camp it was traditional practice, and when the tent couldn't take any more, he loaded all the bottles into a lorry and took them away to a dump. For the sake of peace, I didn't want to interfere with that practice.
They were truly frontier days.
When we took the pay down from Bulladeel to Karoo, we used to take a shotgun.
We had our own bed, you know. The beds were provided, and a cupboard alongside the bed, and a chair you could sit in. No carpets on the floor. The tents were boarded up to about 2 foot height. We had a cook, Edgar, as I remember him. When he was sober, produced reasonable meals.
Don McDean is a former labourer, ganger and bulldozer driver. He worked on the Bulladeel to Karoo section of the highway during the 1950s.
We had a little 10x10 igloo thing for each bloke. Oh, it wasn't too bad. It was had a big galley, cook your own feed. Used to have a bloke in the yard, and he'd have the water boiling for you when you got home and the fire lit to cook your tea, and had the hot water in that there for you to have your shower, and it was pretty crummy showers too. Oh, yeah, we used to just have a big barbecue, and the pipes for the hot water, they run through the big barbecue and up into a 244-gallon drums stuck together, and that was our hot water supply.
So what was the atmosphere like in those camps then? Was it good?
Oh, fairly good. It was what you made it. You know, sometimes it used to get a little bit hopstropless, but used to quieten down.
Anyone ever complain about the conditions?
Well, it wasn't much good of complaining because you didn't get anything done for you. Yeah, well, them days we had to nap all the big stone down to a certain size, and then they used to put the grid rollers over it. Once we got them down to, say, 6 inches, see, some of the rock used to be up to 2 foot across. We used to have to bash them down to that size. You had to more or less look for the grain in the rock and if you knew where to hit, they'd fall apart fairly easy. But if you didn't, you could bash there all day.
Equipment was often basic. Tom Hope mentions mostly hand labour, and on the Pacific Highway in 1937, a lack of mechanised construction machinery.
It was mostly handwork or pneumatic-tired tractor-drawn equipment, even horses and drays. And out in the western part of the state, camels and drays.
In those days, we were very short of construction equipment. What bulldozers we had were ex-army and had already exhausted their first life, so continually under repair.
McDean also worked on the Karua section of the Pacific Highway. Some of the rocks that he unearthed were monumental in size.
It took two HD20s one day to get one out of a hole down at Karua, and that was, I'd say it was 8 foot high by about 10 foot wide. And I couldn't lift him, so I got my mate to come in with me, and we got him out in the finish. And he's still sitting down there for anybody to see, actually.
Did you ever see any accidents?
Yes, I see a bloke, he was dozing one day in a quarry, just out of Bulladela, and he went in under this big shelf of rocks, and the rock face fell on him, and it smashed the tractor into three pieces, and put him into hospital and crippled him for the rest of his life.
What was his name, do you remember?
Digger Magaway. Yeah, and he went to Waratah after that, and they gave him a job in the laboratory. He supposed had a job there for life, and when the laboratory closed down at Waratah and went into divisional office, they sacked him because he was crippled up that way that they used to pick him up from his house and bring him into the lab. And when they moved it into Waratah, they just said, well, we're not picking you up anymore, and he couldn't get the job. So they done the dirty on him.
How was the DMR as an employer, though, generally? Were they good employers?
Oh, they wasn't too bad.
Big changes in the use of construction equipment and materials occur during the 1950s.
The changes in the years that I was in the main race was so dramatic it looked like going to another planet. When I first joined the main race on the Belmont Climbing Lane work, we introduced bulldozers, which were just imported from overseas, which had hydraulic rippers, which were the first to be used by the main roads in this state, and hydraulic blades. And before that, we had the old type tractors with cable mechanisms, which looked like a horse-drawn vehicle. We came then, got into the era of vibrating rollers, which minimised the use of water on the roads. We came into concrete paving machines, sophisticated machines, could do up to 2 kilometres of concrete pavement per day, or 8 metres wide. Sophisticated levelling gear, laser levelling, the type of trucks being used, the bitumen sprayers. It was a complete evolution, really, plant over those years, and which is, since I've left there, has even gone even much further.
Bitumen at the time, well, typically in country areas, was the flash seal, as it was always called. Gravel was a graded stone down to dirt, which was packed and attempt to get the right amount of moisture in, roll it and grade it. And then a spray, usually of tar, went on as a binder. That was used mainly because tar would stick to anything. Bitumen is a lot more choosy. And then a spray of bitumen went down, and while it was still hot, chippings or screenings or fine broken stone, and then the traffic was asked to move fairly slowly for the next week or so while the bitumen set up a bit, which they didn't do. So country work, flash seal work, I used to average 7 broken windscreens to the mile.
My first appointment was to the Port Macquarie Works office, and I was the assistant works engineer. But in the time I was there, we did some work on the Pacific Highway, and we would had one of the failed attempts on the Clybucker Flats north of Kempsey, because the road was nearly worse afterwards than before. And there was various, over the years, various theories coming out as to how to fix it. The year I was there, the current theory was to use tar stabilisation. In other words, mixing tar in with your road-based gravel and then sealing, which we did. It was an absolutely shocking job to work on because of the tar fumes. Men that worked on it, you know, tar fumes just burnt all of their skin and in current day, I mean, work cover would kill you. You just wouldn't be allowed to work in those conditions. But we did it, and we got it. We finished it, but within about 12 months, it had all deformed and gone back out of shape again. The theory of the tar stabilisation just didn't work up there or wasn't suitable for that location. And over the years, there's been all sorts of stabilisation across there. I think cement stabilisation, probably some lime, and it wasn't until very recently when they actually put a concrete pavement across there. It is the only answer. But there was many failed attempts on the Clybucker Flats over the years.
Because of the scarcity of road-making materials, they had used a limestone aggregate on some of the sections, particularly south of Kempsey. The only snag was that that limestone over time had got polished date, and in wet weather it was like an ice skating rink. And I can recall there were six vehicles in one collision, like a stock car derby at one stage. So I don't think there was anybody hurt, but it prompted a fair bit of response and then using a different type of aggregate for reseal.
In the post-war years, the Pacific Highway from Cowan to the Hawkesbury River became totally inadequate in the face of increasing motor vehicle ownership and population growth. At this time, the Central Coast was becoming a popular tourist area.
There was congestion between Sydney and Newcastle, mainly. What happened in the people, even in those days, didn't go on the longer type holiday trips. The Central Coast was still a fairly powerful, significant tourist area. I think in the 50s there was up to 18,000 vehicles per day in holiday period on the road. And clearly it was a torturous trip on the old Pacific Highway. And it took over five hours to get to Newcastle, and it probably took, you know, at some stage 3 hours to get to Gosford and the entrance in those holiday places up there.
Kevin Kirkland was a driver in his father's bus company during the 1950s.
Well, the road was very narrow, windy, and some sections narrow and dangerous. It would take sometimes, I remember from Gosford to Sydney, on a Sunday afternoon, it took us up to 5 hours to get to Sydney.
The obvious solution was to build a freeway from Sydney to Newcastle, a very ambitious plan at the time. The decision to build the first section from the Hawkesbury River to Mount White was taken in 1960.
It was at this time that the first of the big contractors looking for roadworks, well, they were all saying, you know, you fellows just play around with building it, give it to us and we'll build it cheaper and we'll build it well. And Neville Wran was Premier, Pat Hills was Minister for Roads. Pat Hills wanted to get them off his back a bit. Howard Sherard as Commissioner for Main Roads at the time, he wouldn't have a bar of letting this stuff out to contract. He just didn't want to be in it. So anyway, Pat Hill said, well, the best way to get rid of them is give them a go, call tenders. And very quickly, under his direction, a tender specification was put together to design and construct a toll road from Sydney at least as far as the latitude of Gosford. We're all convinced. No tender. None of them would know how to write a tender for that. They had no way of getting an estimate of cost. They'd be shooting in the dark. Didn't expect any tenders. Tender time was up. Opened the box. There's two tenders in there. One from the Tease Brothers, which was a load of rubbish, completely non-complying. It went straight into the bin. That was the end of that one. The other one was from a man named Solomon. None of us knew who Solomon was. An address in London. Wow. Sherard's immediately offside to him. He didn't want him. And one of the requirements was the tenderer had to have in hand, in effect, £50 million to start. Solomon gave as the source of his £50 million, £50 million that he had in the Bank of England in London. Direction to the legal officer. Jeff Sheldon was the chief legal officer. Would you make arrangements and ring the Bank of London and find out if a Mr. Solomon has £50 million and is earmarked available for this? And I said, please, Mr. Sherard, can I stay back with him that night for the phone call? I won't talk. So Jeff put the call in about 8:15 one night. And as soon as he started to talk where he was from, what it was about. Yes, at the other end, the Bank of England, yes, you wish to speak to Mr. So-and-so. Mr. So-and-so came on the line. Yes, you're inquiring about Mr. Solomon and his assets to get a major road built. Yes, he has got $50 million lodged with us for that purpose, and he would have access to more money. Well, that would be pretty obvious if he had $50 million in the bank sitting. Oh. We couldn't get to work soon enough the next morning to tell Sherrard. Is the proposal economical? Well, that was my job. The road works typically if you cost the cost of the road and the cost of the benefits, and you put one over the other and you get a cost-benefit return, and any reasonable road work pays 10% or better. The largest one I'd ever seen was 22% benefit over cost per annum. This came out over 40. Wow. So I was directed to do that and have it ready within... Yeah, Sherrard, you know, he didn't give you much time to do things. Next meeting committee, I said, it's 42%, it's da-da-da-da. That's enough. I don't want to hear any of the tech... Oh, I don't. So he had to report to the minister, Pat Hills. And then I was told to be ready at 11 o'clock with the plans and figures and the mosaic in the recreation room. The doors are locked. Then in comes Sherrard and Pat Hills and nobody else. Oh. So anyway, Pat Hills heard it right through. And then he looked at Sherrard and he said, well, Howard, I think we give him a go. Well, I'm sitting here or standing there watching history being made now. And then the next line from Sherrard, Mr. Minister, you've got to give yourself another commissioner. I'm not going to do it. Whew. Pat Hills looks at me with a little bit of a grin and he says, that commissioner of yours hits hard, doesn't he? And that was the end of that.
Eric King was engineer in charge of outer freeways construction at the DMR.
Yeah, it was a challenge, I suppose, because we were moving into earthworks, the size of which we'd never tackled before. Drilling, blasting were of a magnitude that we'd never had before.
That was the showpiece of highway engineering in New South Wales, and probably rated as good or better than anything else in Australia, and was at that stage almost world class. And that was great, because you really felt you were working on a project that everyone that drove a car was looking at with admiration and saying, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if we had interstate highways, etc. like that. So it was good. It gave me a different insight, because I'd gone from the construction to design side, so it gave me a totally different appreciation of road design. But the beauty with the Sydney-Newcastle was that it wasn't like the normal rural highways where you were building very much to a budget. At that stage, the standard was to build a very high-speed, safe road and then see what it was going to cost, rather than we've got to build X kilometres of road for Y amount of money. We went to 4 6-lane divided, completely access-controlled highways. Everything else was just two lines.
There was a challenge of moving thousands and thousands of cubic yards of sandstone in such a manner as could be assured of being stable in embankments which were up to 80 feet in depth, and cuttings are almost as high as that also.
Well, I think the single biggest challenge was the what we call the big cut and the big fill, which are on the south of the Hawkesbury River. It was the biggest cutting and the biggest fill, and I think it still is the biggest fill that we've ever built in Australia for a road. One big problem that you have to be careful of is the effect of blasting on properties nearby. Fortunately, for a lot of the work we did up there, it was out in the uninhabited areas, but when we got down around Moonee, we had to be careful. People have got cracks in the walls of their buildings, and they complained, and we had to then we adopted a system before we moved into an area. If there was a house or a building that could be involved, that was inspected and photographed and so on before the work started, and then checked afterwards. We had one claim from an establishment at Mooney, which we knew could not have been affected by our blasting, but we paid up because it was a convent and we couldn't dispute the Mother Superior that she wasn't telling the truth. We had one unfortunate accident on the job when a rock was pushed over from one of the contract dozer driver, pushed a rock over the side, which was too big to have been pushed over, and he pushed it over, it bounced off a berm and bounced down on the Pacific Highway down below and landed fair on top of a car and killed two people. The car was just driven into the road. They didn't know whether it was they were male or female or what, but the whole thing was just squashed into the road. The whole thing sounded very callous, but the insurance company who were handling the matter came to see me, and the chap said, "Oh, look," he said, "we've got nothing to worry about." He said it was an old chap and his son, and he said, "There's only the mother left," and he said, "she's pretty old, and she won't last too long," and he said the son was a bachelor, so payout's going to be minimal. He said, and I nearly threw him out of the office. This fellow had no feeling at all about the suffering that woman must have gone through.
There were some problems with the pavement surface on that first section of the freeway.
Well, on the initial length, the asphalt that was laid as the finished surface was a dense graded asphalt. And the water, during times of rain, well, rainfall, the water, although it was running off the road to the drains at the side, there was always a thin film of water on the top. And when a car was coming around the curve, and the curves were really too small in radius for the speeds that the cars we were adopting, and quite a number, and it was a combination, I guess, of worn tyres too, but the car could lose traction or lose attraction in the rear wheel spin. And of course, once it gets out of control, there's nothing you can do about it. You've just got to go with it. So there were a number of these accidents occurred, and I actually witnessed one once when I was in the car with Mr. George Faulkner, who was the engineer in chief at the time. We were following a car during rain, and this actually happened. The car smashed into the side of the cutting. Nobody was hurt, but the car was dented, but it was drivable, and the chap drove away. But that's when we started looking for means of avoiding or overcoming this problem, and they developed this open-graded mix, which suited our purposes, and we overcame that problem.
There were also problems with the route of the highway planned to go through a national park.
When you get up near Mount White, you'll notice a cutting that heads off to the right, where over a million cubic yards of rock was taken out, and you know that's $1 million worth or more of work was done and abandoned. The intended route of the freeway was to go down through this cutting. It was a shorter route, but certain people in the national parks and wildlife, this route went through national park area, so they said they didn't want it to go through this area. It was the logical route to take. It was the shortest route and the easiest one. But here you have the situation within a government where one government department is up against another government department, and one minister against another minister, and a premier is not game to make a decision. And after a lot of argument, it was decided that we would abandon that route and take the route that it follows now. And the funny thing was that after we'd made that decision and we'd started to do the redesign, the minister who handled the National Parks and Wildlife Service went on leave, and the minister for Main Roads took over in an acting capacity for the National Parks and Wildlife Service. And during that time, he signed a document which extended another national park, and it included the new route of the road. And immediately, National Parks and Wildlife Service asked for the road to be diverted again. And our minister was in this position of having signed the document. After a lot of argument, sanity prevailed and we stuck to the line.
Eric King recalls the circumstances regarding the official opening of the Barara to Hawkesbury section of the freeway, involving the then Minister for Roads, the Honourable Pat Morton.
We had a section to open when we moved on this, the southern side of the river. They wanted to open the section on a certain date. We thought we'd open it January of the following year. And our minister at the time said it wasn't good enough. It had to be before Christmas so that the Christmas traffic could have it. And then he had a bright idea that his birthday was in October. And he said, well, that's the date I want it opened. And we said, it's impossible, sir. It cannot be done. And then the commissioner, John Shaw, at the time, he said, it can't do it. So the minister turned to me and put me right on the spot and said, you can do it, Mr. King, can't you? And I said, I'm sorry, the commissioner said we can't, and we can't. He said, well, what would you need to be able to do it? I said, we'd have to work two shifts a day, and we would need another, I forget the amount now, maybe $1 million or so extra. And all he said was, you've got it. And we did it. We opened it on the 27th of October, which was the minister's birthday.
The next section of the freeway was the Warunga to Barara sector, and here the DMR ran into some considerable environmental problems.
The line that we'd selected ran through Muagamara Sanctuary, and there was a particular baronia growing in that area that only grew there. Grows nowhere else along the escarpment. And the chap who looked after the Muagamara Sanctuary appealed to us to shift the line to avoid it, and we did.
Six wombats had been observed. Wombats, if they're on a regular route, typically a route to water, they're not going to be deviated off that by anybody. You put a fence up, they'll go under it.
So we put in this big corrugated sheet culvert to enable the movement across in this national park where we'd gone, so that they could move within the park without any trouble. And when we built it and put it into operation, there were a lot of jokes and things about whether you had to put up signs telling the wombats where to go and so on. But to establish whether it was being used or not, they'd spread sand at the entrance to the or through the culvert, and prints would be checked, and it was used. They could tell whether it was a wombat or whether it was a rat or a bush rat or whatever, and certainly was used.
So the wombats are smarter than you think?
The wombats didn't need to be instructed, yeah.
Anyhow, the location was finalised, more or less, with acceptance of national parks. It went to the minister. The minister asked for a formal model to be made, which was quite an elaborate model. Anyway, the model went to Laurie Brereton as minister, but the minister was still worried or concerned environmental significance and whether this job should take such a high precedence. One of his phrases I can still remember, why do we need a freeway leading from the Blue Blood country to the north? Why don't you build more roads out Bagstown way where the real people are? I thought on that one and I thought of an answer for that. I said, the people living up north round Woi Woi are retired good Labor voters, and the traffic is their sons and daughters going to see them at the weekends.
The Pacific Highway crosses an area of high rainfall, and floods were among the major events that have affected the highway.
Big flood of October 49 came down the Macleay River. We were getting wireless reports all the time from up at the Bellbrook, I think was the place, and the flood has risen to 40 feet, the flood has risen to 45. Oh, God, what's that going to mean? Kempsey Road Bridge over the Clay River did not close. The railway bridge did, because a road ferry further up took a span out and then came tearing down, and it was almost a dead cert it was going to take the road bridge out as well, and you couldn't do anything about it. But it neatly fitted between two piers and kept on going and finished up in a street down in Smithtown. We got it back into the river and managed to tow it back up again. There, down across the Clybucca Flats, the water was 20, 25 feet high over the highway. There was debris up in the telephone wires. The reaction of the authorities that could do something about it was quite good. They were fast. The Army was up there with the Army ducks within a day or so. The Air Force was flying around with DC-2s and DC-3s, pushing loaves of bread and sides of meat out the side, and people were on top of the roofs of their houses because the water, as the water got deeper inside, they went up into the ceilings and they finished up on the roof, and they've got their hand over their heads hoping all the RAF planes will miss. Who wants to get hit with a side of lamb from 500 feet up? And fortunately they all missed, and that was that.
Up on the north coast, and you can get some very, very heavy rains, and they just got waterlogged. They couldn't move. A lot of dairy farms up that way, they couldn't get their milk out, and their cattle couldn't be moved. They couldn't go to sale. They couldn't do this. So it was for them to have a road that was available there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, was a godsend to them.
One of the differences with the Pacific Highway and other highways, the original communities, they learnt to live with floods. They didn't want to be up in the hills thinking about a floods. They wanted to be on the rich country next to the rivers, and they learnt to live with floods. And that thinking continues with road planners. We can't beat the flooding on the Pacific Highway, so let's learn to live with it. I hope the new work they're doing at Raleigh doesn't get washed away when the Bellinger River really comes down like it did in the 50s. Even in around Taree, the Taree Bypass. North of Taree is going to be underwater. So we've built this lovely bypass here. God help us when it's raining, we'll be able to stand on the bridge and look at the flood water, because you won't be able to go anywhere.
You can't really block a floodway. If a road, if an area of land floods and you put a road across it, above the flood level, all you'll do is alter the flood pattern, and that is environmentally disastrous. You can back flood water up and flood properties upstream that have never been flooded before if you do that sort of thing, and then you're in for litigation. So that the best you can do usually on a floodplain is place the road at a level such that it's still negotiable under flood.
For much of its history, with many rivers to cross from Sydney to the Queensland border, ferries have serviced the Pacific Highway. A major source of enjoyment for some, and irritation for others, the elimination of ferry crossings and their replacement by bridges became the DMR's greatest priority. Stories about ferries are legendary, but how efficient were the ferry services?
In those days, I thought the ferry extremely inefficient. And they were quite a nuisance to a young engineer because they were always breaking down. But in addition, the ferry drivers seemed to be in continuous arguments and fights with the travelling public, particularly if they fell asleep on duty at night. It was the ferry's 24-hour service. And quite often the drowsiness was helped by the contents of a bottle.
Were there any accidents ever on those ferries?
Yes, I can recall that when cattle were placed on a ferry, unless the position of the cattle was controlled, the cattle could sink the ferry because when they perhaps panicked and moved into a corner, that would sink the ferry. I remember the Rocks Ferry, it was over the Maria River, that was lost because of cattle moving to one corner.
¶¶
In my early days at Port Macquarie, in those days there was a sergeant and an Irish constable stationed at Port Macquarie. That was the total number of police in the town. And the Irish constable rang me one night and said there was a queue of people in cars waiting to cross at Blackman's Point, and the ferry was not on the bank. In fact, the ferry driver was intoxicated and he was inviting the cars to have a jump, holding the ferry a few metres off the bank of the river. So I don't think he had any transport. So I collected the constable and took him down to the ferry, and sure enough, there was the driver on the flap of the ferry yelling out to all the motorists, have a jump, test their cars. So we tried to get him onto the bank so he could be put in the safe hands of the police. Nothing happened, he wouldn't move. So the constable got out his rule book and said, well, he couldn't arrest him where he was because technically he was in charge of a vessel at sea. He didn't have that authority. we had to patiently coax him to the bank, and after a couple of hours, the constable took him off and we put a relief driver on.
One of the mishaps I had personally was the ferry at Port Macquarie. One night I drove onto the ferry and it wasn't chained up, and my front wheels were on and the back wheels pushed the ferry out, and half my load went underwater, and it was a bit of a drama getting... I had a load of tomatoes on, and it was a bit of a drama getting it back, the ferry back to land, because the rear end of my truck dug into the sand, and we had to get another truck. I had to dive in and get a chain around it and get another truck out on land to pull us in, the ferry and myself in. We had to chain the truck to the ferry so he didn't pull me right off, and I lost half the load with salt water. Yeah, but it could have been a lot worse. The whole truck could have ended up in the water. It was quite a loss to us on that. We could have took action. It would have cost the ferry driver his job, and I think we would have missed a lot of ferries after that. So we let bygone be bygones and wore the claim ourselves.
In 1966, the last ferry crossing on the Pacific Highway at Harwood was replaced by the last steel bridge built by the DMR. The highway has a rich history of bridge building, an innovation in bridge design. Most bridges were built during the last decade of the 19th century, and with the DMR's program of increased road widening, bridges became too narrow for the traffic using it. The Boyd's Bay Bridge at Tweed Heads was typical.
It was quite a narrow two-lane bridge. I think its vintage was somewhere around about 1920, 1918, that sort of thing. It was a lift span bridge, and it was the only one that I've come across where it was, and it was still being lifted up until the last few years of its life. And it was lifted by hand winching. You had to get three men on a big crank handle and wind it, and the bridge went up. And you pull the handle out and let it go down and hope it jumped back in the same. And it just hung on cables, and often when it would come down, it wouldn't sit back down on its bed properly. The second one was the bridge at Barney's Point, which is south of Tweed Heads. It was another lift span bridge that really caused a lot of problems in its later life, because we had a cruise boat operating on the river going up and down at least once a day and every time demanding the bridge be open, so that the highway was in fact closed for a period of perhaps 10 minutes at least twice a day. And while in non-peak times that was just a nuisance, that used to cause some spectacular traffic jams, in the Christmas period sort of thing. And our understanding always was that the boats had right of way and the boat captain could demand at any stage for that bridge to be open. That caused a lot of trouble from us from a council point of view, because not only did the bridge have to be open, we had a water main slung underneath the bridge, and that was a water main of 600 mil, two feet diameter. It had to be drained, turned off, disconnected, and because it was a swing bridge, actually had to take a piece out of the main to allow it to open. But yes, they would have been the most polished bolts, I think, ever, because, I mean, they were getting opened up and done up in most cases twice a day. But that was replaced with a higher-level six-lane bridge. And that was only opened in about the mid-90s. I think it was about 94, 95, something like that.
By the late 1970s, the DMR was building at least one major concrete bridge a year on the Pacific Highway north of Newcastle. Brian Pearson recounts some problems with the bridge at Mooney Mooney.
We balanced the superstructure block by block as we extended the superstructure both sides of each pier. On the northern side, we had reached the abutment and we had temporarily set the abutment of the deck on bearings, and we were finishing off the centre of the bridge when the bridge started to swing or rotate about its pier. This was a frightening experience because we could have lost the whole bridge. However, quick thinking by the people on the site saved the bridge. They attached steel cables to the abutment end and held it in place, preventing the superstructure from toppling off the top of the pier.
Yeah. And how much of the bridge was built by that stage?
The bridge was nearing completion.
That would have put your reputation in tatters, I think, if it had collapsed.
Well, we're very proud of our record. Up to that stage, to my knowledge, we had never lost a bridge during construction, and we never had a fatality on a bridge during construction, except on the harbour bridge.
The Kempsey Bridge was a replacement of a bridge literally in the town over the Macleay River because the old bridge was literally falling apart. The timber bridge was being demolished by a crew that came up from Newcastle. The bridge, because of its weakness, had a Bailey Bridge support and was also under trussed, so that you literally had tied the thing together. And my paymaster's duties, I just happened to say to the foreman, because they were 30 feet above the water, "Where's your life buoys?" which they were supposed to have at the site where they were working. And dear old Norm said, "It's in the shed, Terry." So I suggested they get it out of the shed and put it alongside them where they were working. The bridge fell down the next week, and the first thing that they apparently thought of was to throw these life buoys down into the water, and I think there was six of them hit the water. And when they came up, they just draped their arms in these life buoys, and we lost one chap who had only come back to work after being on workers' comp because he was lonely, sitting on his own in the camp. He came back to work at 9:45, and he was dead by 12 o'clock. So I think he was destined to go. We had an explosives expert who had been an ex-Vietnam Green Beret guy, a Yank, and he was going to do all sorts of great things in training our powder monkeys who'd been around for yonks. And he showed us a new way to shoot material for this immediate approaches at the bridge at Blackman's Point, which was a very heavy basalt. The only trouble was when the boys came back the next day to load it into the trucks, they found all these unfired explosive shots, which could have killed any of them. And as a result of that, and my discussions with the then divisional engineer at Newcastle, this guy was fired.
I think the bridges that are being built today are very good structures. I think the rate of bridge building's tapered off, largely because our road construction has tapered off. When I was chief engineer bridges, we were constructing bridges at the rate of up to 160 a year, and I haven't noticed that rate is continuing these days. But the bridges that are being built are still very good quality.
For the first five decades of the 20th century, almost all freight to the mid and north coast regions of New South Wales went by ship or rail. Today, almost all freight movements are by road. What has brought this radical change about?
The thing is about the flexibility of trucks is the rail freight is really either focusing on commodities like sugar and stuff out of Grafton, or it's focusing on Sydney-Brisbane. containers and these sorts of products. It doesn't do the local distribution as well as the trucks. And the way that the road network's changed overall in Australia-wide is that very little warehousing goes on these days. And the North Coast is no different than the rest of Australia or the United States. Big supermarkets. The warehousing occurs in the trucks and in the supermarkets. You're getting products going directly from supermarkets, from suppliers or from big distribution centres. The flexibility of road freight does that. And the other thing about freight, there's an awful lot of perishables on the road network. Tomatoes are grown in Bundaberg and eaten in Sydney. So that, of course, the urban population of Sydney has consumed its agricultural areas, and so it's the road networks enable that sort of, the Pacific Highway especially has enabled that sort of agriculture to occur at those places because the markets now are more accessible. Accessibility in the rail system is nowhere near as good as it is on the road. The rail system's accessibility has remained static probably for a good 70 or 80 years. Well, the accessibility in the road's improved out of sight. I mean, just sitting at Newcastle, the rail system's no faster now than it was in the 30s. It's the road network's 3 hours faster.
Tom Lindsay started in the trucking industry with his brother in Coffs Harbour in 1953.
The 10 years I drove, we started off with 5-tonne trucks with 8-tonne payload, and it took us 12 to 13 hours to Sydney. Today, grossing 43.5 tonne of trucks do it in 6 hours. In those days, the 5-tonne trucks had a 5-speed gearbox with a 2-speed button. The 2-speed was like about a quarter of an extra gear. You could press that button and stay in the same gear without changing the gear lever. And many areas you would change back 3 gears on a flat to go through some of the potholes. It was quite common to have a puncher, at least one puncher every trip.
The volume of traffic has increased, the speed of the traffic has increased, the power of the vehicles. They could go across rough roads faster, across bridges faster. As a result, a lot of these things got damaged. They were damaged because of the dynamic energy that hit those bridges and bad roads at the higher speeds, and that caused pavement destruction. As a result, the road engineering had to be completely rethought to cope with these higher speeds and higher weights.
Bruce Parks is now planning and analysis manager at the RTA's Grafton office.
There's certainly going to be an increase of trucks. The surveys that we've done and the traffic studies that we've carried out have shown that that there's going to be a bleed off from the New England onto the Pacific Highway. As soon as Buller Dealer is open, for instance, it's a saving of around $60 a trip. Even later when Burringbow is constructed and built, that's the section north, there'll even be greater savings. Could be $100.
Kevin Kirkland's father started the local bus company in Nimbin because it was a lot easier to load passengers than bananas. Kevin, continuing in this tradition, took delivery of his first bus in 1945.
It was impossible to bring it up the Pacific Highway because of the sharp corners and the ferries. There were about 5 or 6 ferries to cross, and there's no way in the world you could get a semi-trailer up that highway. So the actual delivery of that semi-trailer bus had to be done by the New England Highway, and that's how it came to this area. In 1959, we started our first long-distance tours from Brisbane. It would take us 3 days to get to Sydney. The experienced driver knew and could read the road like a novel. You knew where the corners were, you knew every corner virtually backwards. In fact, one old lady said to me, "You seem to know every pothole on the road." And I said, "We ought to, we make them all." There was a sort of a feeling of hopelessness about the improvement of the highway. You could see these things were happening, that it was a dangerous road. And you always had this feeling. In fact, one of my friends, before he ever got into a bus and drive, used to cross himself. And this was the attitude, you know, you're a bit like a kamikaze pilot. You never knew, because you're only missing other vehicles and trucks and heavy vehicles by anything up to 18 inches or 2 feet in the road width. And sometimes at 100 kilometres an hour, you never knew with human error when your turn would come. And that was the attitude that you used to have. As safe as you'd like to drive and as steady as you'd like to be, you were dependent on the other person for their physical skill and alertness for your survival. It's a bit like, I suppose, in the war, they say if you survive the first 6 months in combat, then you've got a good chance of surviving 6 years. And it's the same thing on the road. That if you survive the first 6 months and you get to know the dangers and you get to be aware, you get a sixth sense, you honestly do, you've got a sixth sense of something is pending. And as a result, you can be forewarned about it. But it's a little bit of comparison, I believe, because in the course of the Vietnam War, we sent 46,000 troops to Vietnam to frontline combat. We killed more on the Pacific Highway in those 11 years. There were 600 deaths on the Pacific Highway. There were only about 560 deaths in Vietnam. Everyone called it the killer highway.
Road safety has always been an important issue for the Pacific Highway. But at first, accidents were not reported.
Well, it was only, I think it was 1937, that the police reported accidents to the DMR. So the DMR at the time weren't even involved with any fatal accident investigation. But after 1937, the police only reported accidents that they thought the road had a contributing factor to the DMR, and the DMR would do some investigations. The approach to safety was, we'll improve the design standards so the road would be safe, but the onus was on the driver not to do anything silly. And given the relatively low volumes on the road, the chance of a lot of head-on type accidents are fairly remote.
Peter Stevens is now road safety manager at the RTA's Grafton office.
I saw it as the road. It didn't have any particular danger to me. It was windy. It was interesting to drive. I was a young person with a heavy foot, a wish to travel as quickly as I could. And the curves gave you an opportunity to test your car against someone else's car. Things you would not do today. No doubt the road claimed a high number of victims. People died there. But it wasn't seen as the road's problem. It was the road. You used it how it was. People just pushed it to the limit.
Oh, well, I've seen a hell of a lot of bloody crashes between semi-trailers and people killed and buses, you know, getting burnt. Yeah, there was a crash at the foot of Sullivan's Gap. It was a load of meat coming from up Queensland Way, and he came around the foot of Sullivan's Gap, and he overbalanced on top of this Ford motor car, and it squashed the motor car down to the height of the wheels, and still had the two people in it, tore the top clean off it. Well, I had to give the ambulance flag a hand to lift them two out of that. The lady, she had her arm burnt off, and all the clothes burnt off her. And we had to try and get them out. We couldn't get any help. We had a bus pull up there with about 30 footballers in it, and none of them would give us a hand to do it. And I had on my hands for a week, I had the smell of that woman's body. And I'd done everything to try and get that smell off. Couldn't get it off. You just had to wear it off. It was more or less negligent driving a lot of the people, you know, because a lot of the truck crashes that they had them days, they used to only have young, inexperienced drivers on them. And because they used to give them, say, from Coffs Harbour to Sydney to do the run in a day, and they couldn't do it. And they used to have to force the truck, and they couldn't handle the bends in the road. We'd average nearly one semi a week on the highway.
We were just completing the extension of the bypass and then back, which took us onto the Coffs Harbour boundary. And there was a section of road of about, say, half a kilometre, which was only a deviation, and it was still gravelled until we were doing the main construction. And this chap, he was an ambulance driver, and he was his wife and daughter, and they were travelling from Sydney to Coffs Harbour to a wedding. And about 5 years or so, now, they were involved in a fatal accident. The three of them got wiped out with a truck. It turned out that the girl that was in the back was my nephew's fiancée. So it was a very tragic moment for me. He was most upset. I don't think he's ever forgiven me.
For what?
Well, you know, saying that I was in charge of the road and should have been better, la, 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 la. But when you're doing construction, you have to move the traffic from one side of the road to the other. And if he hadn't driven for about 8 or 9 hours straight, it wouldn't have happened.
John Andrews is a policeman who's patrolled the highway since the 1960s. He has carried out some studies on road accident statistics.
300 kilometres of the Pacific Highway, what we had was almost 80% of our fatal and serious crashes versus the other 7,000 kilometres where we had the remaining 30%. Now, I don't think you need to be a brain surgeon to figure out where you're going to focus your resources to try and combat road safety. And my belief was that we could control them. When we started the program of putting these people on the highways, we divided our 300 kilometres up into four segments, so that theoretically if you drove from Coffs Harbour to the border, you should see four highway patrol cars, marked ones, be they working radar, patrolling, stopping a motorist, whatever, they were there. That had such a significant effect on the road toll in that area that we were able to reduce fatal and serious crash trends by 37%.
People want to travel too far, I think, in one day. Therefore, they're speeding. The road, what is a reasonable standard, is not good enough to travel at high speed. People overtaking in the wrong places because there aren't enough overtaking opportunities as the roads get crowded. Even though we have put a lot of overtaking lanes in, there's just not those opportunities. There hasn't been so many run off the road type accidents. It's been very much dominated by head ons. I think the expectations these days, you know, as roads have got better, you've got the Sydney-Newcastle Freeway, we've got the Hume Highway and other roads are being upgraded, that they expect that style of road or able to drive in those conditions, it doesn't matter where they go. And in that respect, I think, yes, the road has contributed to a fair bit to the accident rate. And of course, cars are better than they were years ago. You can go a lot faster and you get this illusion of being a lot safer, I think, in your car than what you might have been 20 years ago.
There were some very notorious bus accidents in the late 1980s. Can you tell me about those accidents and what do you think might have been the cause?
The first one was in October 1989, and that happened at Cowper, halfway between McLean and Grafton. At that section of the highway, there were three bad waves in the bitumen, and a loaded semi-trailer would have a lot of trouble staying in control if he hit that at any speed. Air-suspended vehicles, such as coaches, ride it out and iron it out very nicely. Air suspension has that characteristic and the ability to do that. But a few months after that accident, at that very spot, I was bringing a spring-suspended bus over the same point. And when I went over those three waves, I could not believe how it nearly threw me through the roof. The road pavement was definitely wavy. And when you go up in the air, there is a tendency to pull your steering because it upsets your steering geometry, and that could easily have pulled that semi-trailer over into the front of the bus. What actually happened was the front of the semi hit the coach's front wheel. It spun the semi-trailer to an angle to the left, and it protruded the steel frame of his semi-trailer into the side of the bus, tore completely along the side of the bus and took 20 passengers with it. Although the truck driver was killed, they checked him out and he did have a degree of drugs in his body, the normal drugs that they take for staying awake. Now, whether you could contribute that to it or not, but I know for a fact that that's exactly where that accident happened, where those wavy sections were in the road. The coroner came out and stated that a four-lane highway would have avoided those accidents.
And then about 4 months later, there was two buses collided north of Kempsey, and I think that killed about 31 people. And the community uproar pressured the government into injecting some money into the Pacific Highway. And until then, the previous 10 years to that, very, very little was done.
How did you feel about the government lowering the speed limit to 90 k's after those accidents happened?
I think it was political knee-jerk reaction to seem to be doing something, and it didn't achieve one thing. In fact, it made the highway more dangerous as far as our drivers were concerned.
Why do you say that?
Well, the general traffic's doing 100 and they're doing 90, and there wasn't a lot of passing lanes, so we were holding traffic up and people were taking risks to overtake in places they shouldn't. It was absolute disaster, I felt, to lower it.
It's my personal view that
speed limit to 90 k's is not a good thing, because you've got two broods of traffic on the same road with two speed limits. And while I'm on that, I should mention that the speed limit of 80 k's for peat plate drivers is also a nuisance. It creates a third layer of speed on the same highway, and I believe that that should not be a condition of peat plates. It isn't in Queensland. In New South Wales, they're made to hold up traffic.
There's a piece of roadway just north of Ballina that is in an area called Tintinbar, and over a 10-month period, I think it was, there were about 14 fatalities on that section of road, and from memory, they all involve heavy vehicles. We were forever pulling trucks off the side of the road, and oft times they'd run into a car going the other way and what have you. 14-odd fatalities in 10 months or so was pretty horrific. You can imagine the publicity that it was attracting. The speed limit on the road there was 100 kilometres an hour, and obviously that was inappropriate. So it was one of the first places where, in consultation with the RTA and through their liaison with the guys at office at Grafton, we introduced a 70 kilometre per hour speed limit to trucks. The bottom line was that once we started enforcing it and got it all in place, I remember the measurement over the next 12 months was not a scratch on a truck nor an injury to any person. It'd be fair to say that when I left up there, some years after that was introduced, there still wasn't any vehicles off the road there, heavy vehicles or people killed or injured. So I think that sort of highlights the sorts of things that we can do from a policing perspective in relation to road safety.
Road barriers, guardrails and signs can reduce fatalities on the highway. They play an important part in road safety and driver recognition.
There was one area north of Telegraph Point, winding area, and we used old ferry ropes as part of the protection fencing, combined with chain wire protection fencing to stop people going off the road. The strange part about it is the new median separations around the motorways in the city are in fact the same sort of principle, with a wire rope which then grabs the vehicle and stretches gradually. But we were using that with old ferry ropes, and we actually caught a couple of vehicles because the chain wire stretched, the other stretched, so that you had a gradual change of momentum and energy, and instead of these vehicles careering down the mountain, they were actually caught like a catapult effect.
So you in fact pioneered this new system of, that they're using now?
No, I didn't. It was an accident, because they wanted to use the old ferry rope somewhere, and this seemed like a good idea at the time.
Terry O'Brien is also concerned at the colour of road line marking.
Overtaking lines should be yellow, as in the American system of line marking, to indicate to people that there is the opportunity for people to come towards you. If you go over these yellow lines, a lane line in a dual carriageway looks exactly the same on a single carriageway as an overtaking opportunity. There was two Americans killed coming out of a service station just above a Clybucker, and I'm sure that they weren't aware of the fact that this was a single carriageway and they went head-on into a semi-trailer.
I think the signage on the highway these days is very good. If you took a driver's viewpoint of a rural section of the Pacific Highway tonight versus a rural section of the Pacific Highway, I don't know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, whatever, would be a vastly different view, because of a night time now, you've got the cat eye markers in the centre and along the sides of the road, so that if you put your headlights on high beam, you've got this absolutely brilliant view of exactly where the road alignment is. In addition to that, of course, you've got the edge lines are pretty well on the highway all the way. You've got the markings on the guideposts, and you've got chevron markers on sharp corners and reflective signs and all sorts of other bits and technology type, modern type stuff, and that's absolutely terrific. So that over night time you've got a really clear view and a very clear picture of where the road goes. You've also got those fatigue rattle strip things along on the edge lines in places that have been tried. Whilst I know they're very expensive, they're going to save one fatality, and you've just saved probably $750,000 in indirect costs to you and I as a taxpayer.
Environmental considerations now play an important part in the planning process of the Pacific Highway. But in the 1960s, it wasn't so.
We didn't know what environment meant in those days. Any solution was an engineering solution. We didn't take environmental into consideration or consult with the public to say, well, this is what you want. we might talk with the local council, and generally that was just out of courtesy.
No environmental impact statements required?
No, no, none at all.
In the 60s and 70s, we didn't do any environmental assessment. You started building, and if you found something you didn't want to know about, you buried it, I guess was the philosophy of the world.
We did strike a couple of places down towards Raymond Terrace there. We had to go through a couple of swamps, and so we had to drain the swamps in and start afresh.
Now, that would be a problem today, wouldn't it, with the environmental controls, would it, to drain a swamp?
It's different today than what it is when we were there, because there wasn't too much greenies around then, and we could knock trees over whatever we wanted to. But now you can't.
Strangely, we were one of the foremost in environmental matters. Even from the very early days when I started, we had a tree planting manual which set out what trees we could plant and why we couldn't cut down trees and all this. And the commissioners of the day were very stringent on that. In another part of the state where I was in charge of some roadworks, there was quite an expanse of tree clearing, and we had to personally answer to the commissioner why that went on, because we were destroying the environment. And this was back in the 70s. Even when they did the Pacific Highway and the Hawkesbury motorway, in those days when they first did them, they had stilling ponds, they had straw bales to put into the streams. They regenerated the embankments, they sowed grasses. So they were very conscious of environmental matters.
More recently, with development of the EPNA Act, there's been a requirement to undertake progressively more thorough environmental assessment. The ones that the RTA produce are reputed to be of the highest quality, most comprehensive. I guess they represent a small cost compared to the overall infrastructure costs, and of course the road has a significant impact sometimes on the environment. So I guess there's a change of emphasis again from the slash and burn mentality of the 60s and 70s to one of being sensitive to the environment. We now employ in this region 3 full-time environmentalists that not only report on projects about to be built, they audit projects underway. We ensure that we're complying with the agreed procedures, and that's been a change with our in-house construction crews as well as with councils in delivering projects. It's impacted on contractors and how they do work. It's impacted on the subcontractors and how they do their earthworks and what they have to comply with. So it's flown through the whole industry.
The RTA can sometimes improve the environment where an environment's been seriously degraded over the years. And when a road system comes through, we plant native species, we provide compensatory habitat, we do an awful lot of things to try and live as much as we can within the environment we're in, and sometimes we can improve it. I mean, just face it, most of the environmental damage has been done by farming and agriculture over the years, as well as the road network. So we try to do our bit, and sometimes the only remnant vegetation is left are on the road network.
Generally speaking, the DMR had good relations with those it dealt with, but there were some notable exceptions.
There wasn't a lot of contact with the people. You know, we come into the office and the DMR, we're the authority, we knew how to do it, don't ask us any questions, we know what we're doing. Well, the only thing we considered 30 years ago was the engineering problems. So we would have said, yes, we want to build a road from A to B. We would look at the best route from an engineering point of view, where we can get good earthworks, the grades are right, the curvature's right, and that's what we would have built. Sometimes the first the public would have known about was when we knocked on someone's door to say, we want to buy your land.
There was a system. We used to enter these properties on a permit to enter, which was just a piece of paper you'd take up and ask the owners to sign. And this was prior to acquisitions being paid for and all that sort of thing. And that used to work quite well most of the time. Sometimes I believe acquisitions weren't complete and paid for years afterwards.
Within our own walls, we determined what we'd build and when we'd do it, and we just went and did it. We told people that we wanted their land and that we'd take it. We'd get them to sign a permit to enter and then fence it off. And later on, we'd come back and acquire it. Sometimes we'd never get to come back. So there were lots of cases when we'd go through and build a new road and never compensate the owner for the change in boundary. We developed a very bad reputation as people that you couldn't deal with. Now, sometimes that comes back to haunt us even today. You turn up to acquire another bit of land and they remember when you didn't pay their father for a piece of land 20, 30, 40 years ago. These days, it's a softly, softly approach of consultation, understanding the needs, and as far as possible, meeting those reasonable needs.
There were a few incidents. There was a pig farmer, who was a rather erratic character up near Wyong, and he rang me up one morning and said he was coming down with a gun to sort me out. Hitting properties of people does affect people. What the heck can you do? We had one suicide, went down that area one night and shot himself.
The highway has greatly improved in recent years and will continue to do so under the RTA's $2.2 billion reconstruction program, but many legacies remain.
Certainly on the Pacific itself, the two major poorly aligned sections are north of Bulladoola and north of Bangalow or north of Brunswick Heads. And those areas are always seen so very difficult and so very expensive to realign.
What was called a black spot was, well, on a map of road accidents, you put a pin in at every accident and it becomes a black spot with all the, where all these pinheads congregate. Barring Bar Range, it's been a black spot for a long time, and the RTA has been considering various strategies to correct it. One of the strategies being a bypass, and it looks as if that's going to happen. That's become the major black spot because all the other black spots on the highway have virtually been eliminated.
Some of our bridges are very, very narrow. There's one just south of our depot here. And your rear vision mirror is over the outside edge of the bridge and it's not safe to pass. There's not a foot to spare. And there's been quite a few bridges like that where the truck drivers call one another up so the closest one pulls up and gives the other one the right of way on a CB. And to me today, in this modern age, that's pretty primitive.
The highway's improving dramatically, but there is still the various sections of it. There's still, I mean, there's sections of highway that haven't changed since I was with the DMR over 25 years ago. Once you get south of Burring Bar Mobile, there are sections of road there that are, you know, got very narrow shoulders. They really haven't changed in 30, 40 years, apart from maybe a little bit of work on the surface. And they're really quite low standard. But that's all got to do with the perception that this major bypass will go in, so there's not a lot of point in doing too much work on them.
In the last decade, the Pacific Highway has been subject to much planning and assessment. In the late 1980s, a study was done by the Northern Regional Office, and this was followed by the North Coast Road Strategy Study, released in 1993. Now an ambitious reconstruction plan is underway. How will this benefit the highway?
It's going to provide significant lengths of dual carriageway. I think the plan's, the objective is some 80% of dual carriageway to the Pacific Highway. It certainly will be targeting bypassing all the major towns. Dual carriageways probably to Port Macquarie, dual carriageways north of Ballina, dual carriageways around that Coffs Harbour area. All the areas where they've got high volumes of traffic will certainly have four lanes. It'll be a much safer highway, much more accessible highway, but there will be more freight using it. I've got no doubt about that. And there'll probably be more cars because people that currently use other roads like the New England may decide to use the Pacific. On absolute terms, we've estimated we're going to get an improvement of travel time between Newcastle and the Queensland border of about 50 minutes. If we didn't spend any of the money that we're spending and the road stayed as it was, we'd be decreasing the current travel time by about 20 minutes. So I think that's a good saving for people.
Some people say highways are ugly, that they carve through the natural beauty of a place and whatever. Beauty is always in the eye of the beholder. And to me, the new Pacific Highway looks like the Mona Lisa. It really does. The beautiful way they're building it, the care and the understanding that the RTA are putting into the construction, the consultation with the various bodies, trying to do the right thing by everybody, I am amazed at their patience and their understanding.
The number of projects that have been implemented and completed amaze me, and the overall standard has improved, but it's nowhere near a good road yet.
It is not a dual carriageway. It does not have the sophistication of design as the Hume Highway has, and it's a long way to go to get it to a high-class road where fatalities can be reduced to minimum numbers.
What we're talking about is higher speeds. Every vehicle can do it, to the cheapest one you can find. And we're talking about through traffic and lots of big freight transports now that travel at high speed also. And against those, where what we have is a road with tractors crossing it, with school buses and pedestrians and turning traffic. And what we're doing is going to duplicate the problems, not duplicate the benefits. Okay, with the availability of the funds they have, what they're doing is dressing up the existing road. And I think in 20, 30 years' time, there'll be so much development on this in this developing area of Australia that you'll probably never be able to come back and go on another route. So there's a conflict in the nature of the road, what they're trying to do.
The more roads we build, the argument is, the more traffic there is. Therefore, we are contributing to the larger global warming issues and the depletion of resources through building more roads. My view is we need to get a balance with an efficient basic network and efficient transport along that network. At the same time, restrict the use of vehicles and the consumption of fossil fuel. Hard balance to get.
Do you have any message to pass on to the RTA as far as their roads are concerned?
Yes, keep letting to private enterprise to build, and we'll end up with a damn good Pacific Highway. It's very satisfying for me to see the standard of the improvements they are now doing.
Well, I was a part of the Pacific Highway Task Force, representing the bus and coach industry. Federal funding for the roads throughout Australia coming from the federal government is $6 billion. That's exactly what it was costing us in accidents. And if I dropped dead tomorrow and somebody asked me in heaven what was my greatest achievement on earth, I would say it was being a part of that National Pacific Task Force, the Pacific Highway Task Force that was successful in getting that funding in place. I did not think I'd ever see it in my lifetime, and now it's happening before my eyes, and I'm a very, very happy person.
The RTA would like to thank all those who took part in this oral history program. The work was commissioned by the RTA Environment and Community Policy Branch. Research, interviews and production was by Frank Hymans. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews on this tape are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent the views of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.